At this time, we'll call United States v. Lewis. Is the appellant ready to argue? The government? Appellant may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, judges of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Benjamin Weatherall, and along with co-counsel Major Jack Einhorn, who represent the appellant, Specialist Joshua Lewis. Chief Judge, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. CID was afraid that if they advised Specialist Lewis of his Article 31 rights, that he might invoke. To that end, they specifically withheld, or deliberately withheld, his Article 31 rights advisement, and Specialist Lewis ultimately made incriminating statements. But CID then bootstrapped and referenced those incriminating statements in all three subsequent interrogations of Specialist Lewis, and they never provided him a cleansing statement. Now, it's for those three reasons, the deliberate withholding of the rights advisement.
Well, the rights advisement pertains to number one, right, and that's not before us.
It does, Your Honor. But when we evaluate the totality of the circumstances in this case, appellant feels that it's necessary to look back and see really what happened through the first, really three interrogations here. And certainly the third one is the one that's before this court. But because of the intentional withholding in the first one, and really then the bootstrapping and referencing of that with the lack of a cleansing statement, it's for those reasons that the military judge got it right in this case. This court should affirm the military judge's ruling. Now, as the military judge noted, and this court has noted, these cases are very fact-specific. But the two cases that best highlight the facts of this case are the Supreme Court's decision in Missouri v. Sieberts and this court's decision in United States v. Phillips. Now, in Sieberts, the Supreme Court specifically rejected the idea of this question-first approach, the let's bring the accused in, not read him his rights intentionally, force a confession, and then after a rights warning, bootstrap that same statement and say, you know, I know you confessed before, let's do it again. And that's essentially what we have here during the first interrogation, is Investigator Delgado brings Specialist Lewis in, fails to advise him of her rights intentionally, gets him to confess, and then says, I know you just confessed, let me read you your rights, you can go ahead and tell me your statement again.
But in terms of citing to Sieberts, didn't the court in Sieberts say that providing rights is a virtual ticket of admissibility, and how do you get past that?
Yes, Your Honor. It certainly, in most cases, right, Sieberts sets up almost the two boxes, Your Honor. And if it's done through actual coercion or in an unlawful inducement, you have this presumption of taint that goes through. And if not, you have this, according to Elstad, you have this totality of the circumstances. And that's where we find ourselves here. And typically, it can be enough. A rights warning can purge the taint, so to speak, and make anything on the backside important. But if we look to the facts of this case, and specifically this court's holding in United States versus Phillips, a very similar fact pattern, this court held that because of this continued referencing to the first statement, the rights warning was not enough.
But in terms of the reference to the earlier statement that was unwarned, didn't that come very late in the process after there was the reading of rights and after there had been admissions made by the accused?
So I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I believe, actually, the record at pages 68 and 69 kind of lays out what happened, really, in this case. And certainly the first thing that happened was there was the right warning. But after that, if you look at Special Agent Becker's testimony, what he says is the first thing that they do is they lay out, this is what's been said in the case, this is the history of what's going on, and they use that to frame what is ultimately going to be the question.
But that's internal. That is not with the accused. They were deciding, based on information that had been provided at the first and second interrogation, how they were going to approach the third interrogation after the rights warning. So that was not shared, that part was not shared with the accused at that time, correct?
So, Your Honor, I actually believe that the record demonstrates, and even after Agent Becker's testimony, you have Investigator Mandel, who observed the third interrogation or the pre-polygraph, the pre-instrument phase of that interrogation. And at a record pages 80 and 90, at page 74, she testified that one of the first things that Agent Becker did was sit the accused down and say, she's telling me this, you're telling me this, these don't add up. And certainly the referencing of you're telling me this of meaning, right, his prior statements. That is the bootstrapping or the referencing back to these unknown statements.
Counsel, how long passed between the second interrogation and the third interrogation, between the second statement and the third statement?
I believe it was just under 30 days, Your Honor.
Okay, so, and I know that Schatzer isn't directly on point, but what are we to make of the fact that the Supreme Court says that even if someone invokes the right to counsel, that after a rather arbitrary 14-day period passes, that the government may nonetheless reapproach them?
Your Honor, I think the time...
I mean, that's a pretty serious right, isn't it?
It is, yes, Your Honor. But I think the time between the different statements in this case, it's certainly a factor in the totality of the circumstances. That's ultimately what we're doing here. But under similar facts, this court held that the 30-day period, which is essentially what we have here in United States versus Phillips, was not dispositive. And it was because of, again, the intentional rights advisement, that bootstrapping back to that intentional rights advisement, and the lack of a cleansing statement, that those three things in that case made the statement involuntary.
It wasn't just those three things, was it?
It wasn't, Your Honor. I mean, there's certainly other factors in that case. I mean, specifically, there was an allotment set up. But I think it's important to note that the specific quote from this court in that case was that it was sufficient to bridge the gap, right? It was even the reference to it. So the agent in Phillips, the law enforcement agent, didn't say, this is exactly what you said to the chain of command in the unworn statement. They just made reference, I'm aware that there's an investigation that had happened prior. And that was sufficient to bridge the gap. Such references quite effectively bridge the gap between the earlier interview and the one that was about to begin. And I believe when Special Agent Becker confronted the accused with those statements at the beginning of that pre-instrument polygraph interrogation, that is what, as this court held, bridged the gap. I think it's also important to note that really what CID here did is it throughout the entire course here, that they unquestionably withhold his rights, get him to confess to something that he should have been warned for. But then every time they continue to bring him in over the 60-day period, so three times and in right around 60 days, to essentially try to build off that investigation or build off that prior to confession.
But isn't it true that after the first and the second times both, that he was free to leave?
He was, Your Honor. That's true.
Isn't that a factor that would suggest to us that his will was not overborne, and which is the test? Do you agree that's the test?
Yes, Your Honor. But I don't agree necessarily that the custody analysis, whether he was free to leave, is dispositive. Again, it's a totality of the circumstances. The judge here actually found that the accused was in custody. Now, as Your Honors have seen from the pleading, there's some questions about whether the military judge considered some factors in that analysis that he should not have under some of the Supreme Court precedent. But I believe the judge came to the right conclusion even if he used the wrong math. And this court's holding from just a couple years ago in Mitchell, at least a similar set of circumstances where this court found because of the military nexus of the commander ordering him to certain places and law enforcement agents being present, that even without shackled and being freed to leave at the end of the meeting, you can still get to custody in a military context. And so I believe the military judge's conclusion that all three interrogations were custodial is correct, even if he used the wrong man.
So building, though, on Judge Ryan's question, where do we find the overbearing of his will? He comes in twice. He's permitted to go twice. Comes in the third time. There's no evidence here that there was any inhumane treatment. There's no evidence here that he was there for a particularly long period of time. When he is asked at the end how he was treated, he says, quote, great. So in light of the fact that he has read his rights that third time, what are we pointing at that says, hey, his will was overborne here. We should not permit this to happen?
Your Honor, I think primarily, first off, when we determine whether will is overborne, I keep going back to, we look at the totality of the circumstances. And while he did say, I was treated great in this, I was not punished or beaten during the interrogation, I definitely believe that all that's true. But under the totality of the circumstances, the three most important facts are, this all started with a deliberate withholding of a rights advisement, and then CID's continued bootstrapping and referencing of that.
We keep talking about bootstrapping and referencing and yadda 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 yadda. But, I mean, is this somehow, here is the poison tree. And are you saying that the fruit is falling off the tree and rolling down the hill, or what? I mean, you keep talking about bootstrapping, but that's all you say.
Yes, Your Honor, and certainly I'm not trying to make this a Fourth Amendment analysis of the fruit of the poisonous tree.
Well, what are you saying?
I believe any time that you reference back to that involuntary or unworn statement, certainly that's what this Court's holding in Phillips stands for, is that if you are referencing back to that statement, you're essentially telling the accused, I know that you've already given this statement, so anything that you give after that, there's no use in fighting it anymore.
But no, that's not what it says, counsel. It says that then you have to look at the totality of the circumstances. The mere fact that they reference something isn't enough. It sort of sounds to me that the military judge here almost thought, and that you may agree, that any time there's a military law enforcement interrogation, right, that happened before, that it is therefore custodial, it is therefore involuntary. And would you agree with me that that is not the law?
That is not the law. No, Your Honor. Custody plays a part of it, certainly. And you're exactly right, Your Honor. It is the totality of the circumstances. And I would certainly not argue before this Court that the bootstrapping alone is sufficient in every case. But when the bootstrapping is to a purposeful, a deliberately unworn statement, right? So then this is police misconduct. This is we're intentionally doing this to violate his rights. And then you reference back to that statement, and then you consider giving a cleansing statement and don't intentionally. I think those factors are what weigh in. And to answer your question, Judge Olson, I think that's really what overbore his will in this case. It's really the police action and then the continued referencing, as I've talked about, is making it seem that there's no reason for you to continue to provide confessions because we already have it in this case.
Counsel, let me ask a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Suppose that we find some of the military judge's findings of fact to be clearly erroneous. For example, we disagree with your position and find that there was no evidence that he was suffering from adjustment disorder at the time of the third interrogation. Just saying, what do we do in that situation? Do we reweigh the totality of the circumstances ourselves?
Well, Your Honor, I do believe this Court can. It is a de novo review. So then
would we give deference to all of the factors that the military judge took into account, or could we reweigh things like his age, his time in the military, his high school education? Would we reweigh those differently, perhaps, from the way the military judge did it? I mean, in other words, once we pull out one fact, then do we just reweigh everything ourselves?
I believe that this Court can, Your Honor. Because the voluntariness of a statement is a de novo review, I believe this Court has the power to determine whether it agrees with the military judge's conclusions of ultimately, what factors weigh most heavily in this case. And this Court and the Supreme Court have said that it's not this has 10 factors and this has 8 factors and not all factors are weighted equally. But what I would say, Your Honor, is I do believe the military judge's conclusion as it relates to the adjustment disorder, I believe there's factual support for that. So number one, I believe that to be a proper inference. The diagnosis was in November, and the statements were given in May, June, and July.
Well, leaving aside when he got the adjustment disorder,
yes,
which seems to be a controverted matter, is there anything in the record to show that having an adjustment disorder makes one more likely to knuckle under to interrogation?
No, Your Honor.
Well, then what's the point?
Well, Your Honor, while that is not the most probative fact in the totality or probative
well,
fact,
I mean, the judge also, I think, found that he wasn't very smart.
Yes, Your Honor.
But again, there's plenty of authority out there that you don't have to be very smart.
Agree, Your Honor. And I don't think that there's necessarily anything in any case, absent the actual duress or coercion, that there's one that is a dispositive. Like, you need this, and if not that, it's dispositive. And so the totality, and I think because he's low average intelligence, he at least the adjustment disorder indicated that he was more susceptible to stressors.
Well, but couldn't the fact that he was charged with an offense be the stressor that caused the adjustment disorder? I mean, I don't mean to make light of the disorder, but isn't that just as likely as anything else?
Well, Your Honor, actually,
we're speculating.
Oh, yes, Your Honor. I believe, actually, in the second interview, so if you look at Appellate Exhibit 6, Enclosure 4, I believe it is, it's the second interview, the one with Agent Singh. He's actually discussing in that interview some of the underlying conditions or underlying symptoms that ultimately the diagnosis of the anxiety disorder.
If my colleagues would indulge me, I have a question for you to consider and get back to on rebuttal. In Lopez de Victoria, the court held, right, that the issue there was, can this court review under Article 67 and Article 62 appeal at all?
Yes, Your Honor.
What we didn't focus on in that case particularly was whether it mattered who it was that was appealing to us, the government or the defense. Would you agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor.
So this is my question, right? You're here on an interlocutory appeal of a trial court ruling.
Yes, Your Honor.
And in the ordinary course, you'd agree that you can't appeal trial court rulings.
I believe you need statutory authority to do so. In this case, 62 to get to the CCA, yes, Your Honor.
Right, but you could not appeal.
Oh, the defense.
You could not appeal a trial court ruling under Article 62.
Yes, Your Honor.
So my question is, I guess, which is, do you think that it makes a difference for purposes of Article 62 via Article 67 that you're the defense as opposed to the government? Because it seems to me, and this comes to light because of the next case we have, is that ordinarily the only way for you to get any kind of relief would be through the All Writs Act or writ of mandamus or something like that. And
yes,
there, basically, we generally say, come back later when the trial is over. So I would just be interested about your thoughts about the ordinary rules for interlocutory appeals and us telling people come back later when the whole trial is over if you get convicted and the situation that you're in here today.
Yes, Your Honor. So just to make sure that I understand, almost the interplay between 62, 66, and 67?
Yes.
Okay. Yes,
and,
Your Honor.
And whether it makes a difference that it's the defense that's here on an interlocutory appeal. And you've done nothing wrong.
Yeah, right? Yes,
we've allowed this to happen. I'm just curious as to whether you thought about it because we haven't directly addressed that particular question, and it's an area of interest of mine.
Okay. No problem, Your Honor. That's definitely something we've discussed, at least as it relates to the next case.
The military judge made a finding that there was implied bad faith by the part of the first investigator, and you seem to be citing that, understandably. But I just want to make sure I understand your position. Are you saying that implied bad faith should be considered in terms of the totality of the circumstances as it pertains to whether the will of the accused was overborne, or are you taking a different path and want this court to take a different path and say, when there is such bad faith on the part of the initial investigator, that, in fact, we should provide a mechanism by which an accused is not prejudiced by that bad faith?
So, yes, Your Honor. Chief Judge, I see my time has expired. May I answer the question?
Answer the question.
Your Honor, it's the appellant's position that we are in totality of the circumstances land currently because that's the analysis the military judge did. And therefore, implied bad faith is a factor in the totality. However, the appellant does believe that this could fall into Category 1 of LSTAT, right, where this is something where, because we're talking about intentional police misconduct, the taint of the first carries through, and you have a presumption of taint that goes forward that the government must then rebut. So to the extent that this court is willing to consider that analysis in affirming the military judge, that is something that the appellant absolutely welcomes. But the appellant believes that the military judge, even using the lighter of the two standards, the totality of the circumstances, he came to the ultimate right conclusion. So whichever way that this court decides it, we believe that ultimately suppression is the appropriate remedy, regardless of which principles apply.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court, I am Captain Allison Rowley, and I, along with Captain Catherine Parnell, represent the government in this case. This court should affirm the Army Court's opinion because the military judge erred when he suppressed appellant's statement in his third interview to Special Agent MV as involuntary. Voluntariness concerns whether the confession is the product of an essentially free and unconstrained choice by its maker. The Supreme Court in LSTAD held that an earlier unborn statement does not presumptively taint the subsequent confession obtained after the administration of a rights warning, absent actual coercion.
Could you speak up just a bit, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Absent actual coercion, duress, or inducement. And this court, United States versus Philip, applied the LSTAD analysis to cases involving Article 31. And in such cases, the test is the totality of the circumstances, that is, the characteristics of the accused and the details of the interrogation.
Now, in terms of totality of the circumstances, to what extent should we factor in the finding by the military judge of bad faith on the part of the first investigator? Why shouldn't this court be concerned about a situation where you pull somebody in, an accused service member, get as much information, and the stated purpose of that first investigator is to do precisely that. Don't warn the person, this person who has a low GT score. Get them to say as much as you can, and then pull them in a second time. Don't read them his rights. Get as much information as you can. Third time around, you don't provide a cleansing statement, but you do read them his rights, where there seems to have been this frog in the boiling water type deal where you lull them into a sense of security, and then with this service member, low GT score, say, now we got you. Now you've confessed after you've been provided your rights. Why shouldn't there be a great concern to this court?
Renner, well, certainly that should be of great concern to this court, and as it did concern the Supreme Court in Siebert. However, this case is distinguishable for several reasons, notably the difference in time. So the third interview occurred 52 days after the first interview. The interviewer who, in the third interview, did not know of the prior rights violation, in no way did not speak directly to that interviewer or the second interviewer. And so there's nothing to show that the third interviewer, Special Agent MB, used the admissions obtained by the withholding of the rights warning in securing and confession. An appellate asserts that Special Agent MB did bootstrap. And it's the government's position that the record does not reflect that. The only reference to appellant's prior statements that Special Agent MB made was asking him, why did you lie in your previous statements? And that was after appellant confessed to the digital penetration. It's also important to note that at the time of the third statement, the cat was not out of the bag. Appellant did not actually confess to the digital penetration. The first two interviews, he merely admitted that he was in the car with the alleged victim, touched her thigh out of reassurance. And that's not a crime. Perhaps it's an admission, but certainly nowhere near on the level of the actual confession that was obtained during the voluntary polygraph.
Counsel, if the person that conducted the third interview was the same person that conducted the first interview and the second interview, would this be a different case?
Yes, Your Honor, I think perhaps this court could find a different result because that would be much closer to Siebert, where the interviewer, that was a deliberate police tactic where they would interview the individual purposefully without reading them their rights, obtain a confession, in that case it was a matter of 20 minutes, and then reading them their rights and having them repeat that same confession. In Siebert, it was the same interview. Again, it was merely 20 minutes. It was the same room. And so by that reference, after the administration of the rights warning, essentially that interview was one continuous interview. Here we have three separate interviews, no bootstrapping. By the time appellant sat down for the voluntary polygraph, he had been read his rights three times, plenty of time to think about whether or not he wanted to consult with counsel and or actually show up to the voluntary polygraph. In light of those circumstances, this court should find that this case is distinguishable from Siebert and that appellant's interview was voluntary. Pending any further questions?
So would you concede the government has a high hurdle here? We pierce the CCA. We look at the military judge findings. Has to be abuse of discretion. Have to look at the evidence most favorable to the government. The burden is on the government to prove that it was admissible. What is it in particular that you would point to say you have met that high hurdle? Could you just kind of summarize that?
Your Honor, this court reviews the question of voluntariness, which is a question of law de novo, and it considers the military judge's finding the facts for clearly erroneous. And even though we do assert that the military judge did make three erroneous finding of facts, this court not even come to those conclusions because of how those facts would have been weighed even if correct. So in at trial, the government had the burden to prove voluntariness by a preponderance of the evidence. And the specific factors that demonstrate the voluntariness are precisely the break in time, the 52 days, as in United States versus Brisbane, where there was a gap of a month and a half, and this court noted that that was sufficient to keep the presumption that's in ELSTAD that that the prior rights violation, that taint does not carry over into the admissible confession. You know, the fact that he had been read his prior rights warning three times, the fact that it's a different interviewer who did not know of the rights violation and in no way coordinated, the fact that there was no bootstrapping. Any further questions?
Thank you, counsel. Does the appellant have rebuttal?
Your Honor, I'll start off by addressing your question about Lopez de Victoria. Certainly when the government appeals, there is a clear statutory ability to do that under 67A. I think, and I don't want to steal the thunder of certainly what's coming after this case, but I believe under the doctrine of potential jurisdiction, because the CCA is making a ruling that could affect the findings and sentence that are ultimately approved, I believe this court does have jurisdiction under that doctrine. Certainly a plain reading of 67 says the findings that are findings and sentence approved by the CCA. So I think that needs to be read liberally to consider the doctrine of potential jurisdiction, I guess, would be my take on that issue. I would like to point out just one fact that my colleague spoke to and said that the only time that he was confronted, the Specialist Lewis was confronted by Agent Becker during the third interrogation was after his confession. That's not true. That is, in fact, the record of trial on page 74. This is, again, from Investigator Mandel. As they're sitting down talking, Mr. Becker said to Specialist Lewis at one point, "She's telling me this, and you're saying that doesn't add up." This is during the pre-instrument phase when they're discussing everything. And Special Agent Becker's own testimony at page 68 and 69, it was during what we call the case fact review. So we're talking about, okay, do you understand what the allegations are, what's been said and what's been alleged, you know, so, but we have to clarify this information in order to formulate the questions to run the polygraph test. So he's saying that because at this point they still think that they're going to run a polygraph. At the very beginning he's saying, this is all the information I have about this case. That is the confronting with him, and that is well before we have the confession itself and well before we have the sworn statement. So certainly this bootstrapping and referencing happened much earlier on.
At that point, didn't they have conducted an investigation? So some of the facts, if not many of the facts, came from the investigation as opposed to from Helms.
Well, Your Honor, actually, I think it's Special Agent Casper testifies earlier that the only thing that Agent Becker had was this two-paragraph summary of the case. He didn't look at the entire case file. But in that two-paragraph summary, the only thing that he had was a summary of what the alleged victim had said and then a summary of what my client had said. So the only facts that are coming out here come from either my client or the alleged victim, and in this case he's being presented with both. And it's that specific discussion of, number one, the first statement that is unwarranted, deliberately unwarranted and involuntary, and then the second statement, which very clearly, even before the rights advisement, bootstraps that. Pending any additional questions of this court, Specialist Lewis asks this court to affirm the military judge's ruling.
Thank you, counsel. Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 10:15.